The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's John Federson reading this week's issue of Indie Week. On our program, this week's date is September the 5th. Of 2023. And it's a fairly hefty issue, so I'd better get to it. Here we go. Lots going on in the cultural and artistic issue this week, but there are some news articles, and I'll start with Durham sanitation workers call for fair wages and stable jobs. More than 30 sanitation and public works employees rallied outside City Hall Tuesday evening before delivering a petition to the City Council with demands for fair pay and immediate $5,000 bonuses, asking that officials acknowledge the extra workload brought on by ongoing staff vacancies and to ameliorate wages that were largely stagnant during the first 2 years of the pandemic. The petition, signed by about 300 city employees and community supporters, comes several months after the council passed a budget that workers say failed to address the step pay increases they did not receive in 2020 and 2021. The council voted for a 2% raise and an additional 4 to 6% merit-based pay increase for all city employees this year, but workers say their current wages and their net earnings since the onset of the pandemic are low, to the point where they can no longer afford to live in Durham and have to work second jobs. Willie Brown, a driver for the Public Works Department who lives in Knightdale and commutes 45 minutes to and from work every day, says, "We should be able to live in the city we take care of." On the weekends, he works at Taco Bell. With the bonus outlined in the petition, Brown could catch up on bills, he says. "Then maybe I could take my wife out to dinner after I finish paying the bills," he says. The petition also demands that employees be paid accordingly for work that falls outside their job descriptions. Before receiving the official title of driver, Brown spent nearly 6 months working as a driver while employed in a different department, he says, and was just compensated for that work yesterday. City Council candidates Sheila Huggins, Benita Green, Carl Rist, and Shanetta Burris attended that rally, as did sitting council members Didriana Freeman and Javier Caballero, who are running for mayor and re-election to council, respectively, and Joan Tay Dunstan, a mayoral candidate. Burris says, "This is the core of our community. We don't think about the invisible hands that make things work. They deserve to be able to purchase homes in the city in which they work, and they deserve respect." Dunstan, meanwhile, said workers need to take more drastic action if they want to spark change. He shouted at least a dozen times, "Strike!" on the downbeats of the group's "What do we want? Fair wages" chant. "Pull those vehicles out," he said. "Park them in the middle of the street and strike." A few minutes before 7 o'clock, the group filed into City Hall. Mayor Elaine O'Neill forfeited her own three-minute announcement period to allow a solid waste worker, Chris Benjamin, to speak briefly about the petition. "Thank you for being committed," said Councilmember and candidate Leonardo Williams. After Benjamin spoke, "I want you to know we're committed as well, and we're going to find a way to get there." Caballero followed with an anecdote about the Chilean coup in 1973. "Next week is the 50th anniversary of the coup," she said, "an event that led a lot of labor organizers to flee the country because they were being detained, tortured, killed. These things are reminders of how important it is to vote, how important it is to participate, show up, and to protest." When Caballero finished speaking, a worker in the crowd raised his hand. O'Neill said time was up, but encouraged workers to sign up to speak at the council's Thursday work session. Next, an article by Jasmine Gallup. As Wake officials try to prevent tenants' displacement, Grosvenor Gardens residents are on the brink of losing their homes. Felix Watson was working their regular shift at Starbucks when they received some of the worst news of their life. Rent at their studio apartment in Grosvenor Gardens was increasing from $845 a month to $1,100 per month. For weeks, Watson had dreaded receiving a letter from their apartment complex. Rent had already gone up by about $50 in the months before, a foreboding signal of things to come. Now an alert was pinging on their phone that the news they'd feared had arrived. Watson says, "I burst into tears. I thought, I'm being forced out of my home. I'm going to be forced back into an unsafe living situation with people who could hurt me. I'm not going to be able to afford to live." The 29-year-old barista trainer has a history of struggling with depression, and the news sent them into a downward spiral. "I was extremely suicidal for about a month," Watson says. "I thought, I don't want to exist if I don't have a home. My friends and co-workers have had to spend the past couple of months talking me down." Today, Watson's mental health is better, but their situation is unchanged. Rent is still set to increase for most residents to $1,100 per month, following affordable housing nonprofit CASA's purchase of Grosvenor Gardens. The Raleigh nonprofit bought the property last year in an effort to keep it affordable with help from Wake County's Affordable Housing Preservation Fund. Even with that loan, however, CASA has a large mortgage to pay off, a consequence of the Triangle's uber-competitive housing market. Ultimately, the organization is thankful it could prevent the historic building located on Hillsborough Street from being demolished, according to a statement from Emma Doss, CASA's Director of Mission Advancement. Quote, "The building and its nearly 100-year-old gardens are a Raleigh historic landmark in a highly desirable location that was at risk of being torn down. CASA is proud to have prevented this naturally occurring affordable housing from disappearing and is committed to the best possible outcome for every single person." Since news broke of the rent hikes, CASA has reached out to some residents, particularly those making at or below 50% of the area median income, the AMI. Like Watson, for people earning less than 30%, of AMI, rent hikes were canceled. For Watson and others, rent hikes were delayed until November. In the past few months, CASA has also given residents applications for other properties with lower rents and offered additional help in the form of financial assistance, applications for housing choice vouchers, and a list of community resources for additional rental assistance, Doss wrote. But for Watson, none of that makes a significant difference. As Watson started a desperate search for another place to live, they had to put aside other priorities in life, like focusing on work or going back to college. Watson had planned to return to school through Starbucks education program, but, quote, "I can't get my life together when my landlord is screwing me like this," they say. Of course, Watson isn't the only one struggling. Since news of that hike broke earlier this year, several Grosvenor Gardens residents have already moved out, such as 27-year-old Alyssa Fisher, who wrestled for months with a decision. Fisher's Grosvenor Gardens studio isn't that great, she says, but she appreciated the independence. "Now I can't afford this $1,100, says Fisher. "While my income says I might be able to, maybe it's 30% of my area median income, I can't do it. I'm paying off student loans, credit card debt. I don't have the extra $255 a month." After getting the news, Fisher looked for an apartment in Raleigh but couldn't find anything in her budget. "At first, I was looking to see if I could sublease a place, but there's nothing for sublease. There's nothing under $1,100 in Raleigh." Eventually, Fisher and her partner decided to move in together. Today, the only way either of them can afford to live in Raleigh is by creating a double-income household. But that's not an option for Watson. The Raleighite says they have had some bad experiences with roommates in the past, even friends, which make them reluctant to risk sharing an apartment again. Watson's looking into affordable housing communities that serve people making less than 50% AMI, but many have waiting lists up to a year long. Even if Watson does find an apartment, they're scared their rent will go up again. What if this just keeps happening, they ask. Even 5 years ago, I never thought this is what somebody would be trying to charge for a studio apartment of this quality. Watson says that public housing is an even worse option, with a waiting list of 2 to 7 years. Even then, you have to constantly update the housing authority on your income in place of residence, Watson says, or they will kick you off the list and you'll go back to square one. Watson considered moving out of the city to a moderately less expensive triangle area like Durham, Chapel Hill, or Carrboro, but that move could risk their job. If they end up having to transfer to a different Starbucks location, Watson could end up with fewer hours or worse tips, they say. Their last resort is moving back in with their family in Wisconsin. But Watson says, I have a life here. I work full-time. I manage my money well. I think I should be able to afford a place to live. Like many other Grosvenor Gardens residents, Watson has had some issues with their apartments over the years before CASA purchased the complex. But rent was so much lower than at any other complex, they were willing to overlook it. Watson says, it's kind of a run-down building, but the rent was $9.75 when I moved in, and that was cheaper than most other things in the area. Fisher, who has lived at Grosvenor for about 3 years, says her neighbors have had to deal with everything from cockroaches crawling across the floor to leaking pipes. Safety is a concern, too, since some windows don't lock, and the surrounding area is dimly lit, says Fisher. This place hasn't been maintained super well, and a lot of us were kind of willing to look the other way because we have such low rent. But if you're going to charge $1,100 for this studio, it needs to be updated. Since purchasing the building last November, CASA has, quote, invested in long overdue building repair and necessary safety updates, wrote Doss. Fisher, however, says she hasn't yet seen significant improvements. In May, a fire broke out in her neighbor's apartment. The incident left her entire apartment smoke-damaged and unlivable for weeks. Without anywhere to go, Fisher jumped from couch to couch. After appealing to CASA for help, she was finally moved to a vacant unit elsewhere in the complex, but that came with its own issues. That apartment was dirty and infested with bugs, she says. She kept asking when her original studio would be fixed and was put off. She reached out to everyone she thought could help, management company employees, CASA employees, even the CEO, but no repairs were made. Finally, at the end of June, a restoration company came to fix Fisher's apartment. She moved back in, but couldn't resettle. Her hallway was still damaged from the fire. Water started running down her walls from her upstairs neighbor's shower. Fisher says, I've gone down every avenue. I've talked to management, the people at CASA. I've called Raleigh Code Enforcement. These things are supposed to be helping me, but everyone's just playing hot potato. As a month-to-month renter, Fisher doesn't have much recourse. She has very few rights in North Carolina compared to her landlord, and even fewer housing options in today's market. Since 2019, Wake County has funded the construction or preservation of 3,500 affordable apartments and 21 affordable homes, according to Mark Perlman, a division director in the Wake County Housing Department. About 1,600, 45% target renters who make at or below 50% AMI. For one person, that's less than $39,700 per year. Growth in Raleigh is so rapid, however, that the county's many loan, subsidy, and construction programs have only made a small dent in the problem. Perlman says the county's trying to create as many very low-income targeting units as we can with the resources we have available. The problem is that money only goes so far. If you charge less rent, you can't build as many apartments. If you build more apartments, you do have to charge more rent. Perlman says we are trying to create units to accommodate those renters who make 50% or below. The Raleigh Housing Authority is trying to expand the availability of resources as well, as far as rental supports. We're absolutely sympathetic to the situation that these renters are in. We recognize that the stock of rental units these workers can afford is dwindling, and so we're trying to keep up. Doss echoed Perlman, writing that the entire team at CASA understands and empathizes with the residents at Grosvenor Gardens. We will continue to work around the clock to find solutions that are impactful and lasting for the community we serve. Grosvenor Gardens residents, though, are angry. Watson and others feel the efforts of CASA and Wake County leaders to keep them in their homes have failed. CASA may be keeping Grosvenor Gardens affordable for hypothetical future residents, but it's become out of reach for 22 current low-income residents, all of whom need a place to live. Next, lead levels and other contaminants in East Durham Park. Now, we've followed this story for a few months, occasional stories written in Indy Week. This story came out in August 24th of this year, and there has been an official study of these parks. Pieces, and it goes as follows. This, pieces of glass and porcelain, more than 70 years old, were found in lead-contaminated soil at several Durham parks, evidence that old incinerators are a likely source, according to a final report released by the city last night, that's to say August the 23rd. The findings by city contractor Mid-Atlantic Associates confirm an underscore sampling conducted in the fall of 2021 by Eniko Bihari, then a master's student at Duke University's School of the Environment. With Parks and Rec approval, Bihari and her faculty advisor Dan Richter sampled soil at three parks because the city had operated incinerators there until about 1950 when they were torn down. I'm going to pause this article to say that I will be editing this reasonably severely because it's statistical and numerical in a large form. I will indicate the high points of lead contamination, but you could go to IndyWeek.com or NC Newsline to read the full story that has the levels and other side issues. Lead contaminants are not the only one at these sites. All right, to continue then. Top parks officials initially ignored or suppressed Bihari's results, nor did Duke University inform the public. After a Walltown resident stumbled upon the paper online and published the data, the city still downplayed the results but did hire Mid-Atlantic to conduct further testing at these five parks, Walltown, Northgate, Lyon, East Durham, and East End. Preliminary results prompted the city to fence off contaminated areas. All the parks except for Northgate are in predominantly Black and Latinx neighborhoods. Lead is a neurotoxin. Chronic exposure can cause permanent neurological and brain damage in children who are especially vulnerable because they spend time outdoors and often put their hands in their mouths. Adults with high blood levels of lead can suffer from brain, kidney, heart, and reproductive disorders. Mid-Atlantic also tested for other metals associated with incinerators, including arsenic, manganese, and cobalt. Levels in all but one sample were within naturally occurring ranges. They can be present in soil because of local geologic formations and conditions. The report recommends the city maintain its fencing around these hotspots and further investigate those areas. There are several possible cleanup options, including excavation, land use restrictions, or placement of a cap on the contaminated soil. And it says, here, this is a summary of the findings, which I'm going to curtail in any event, but you can read the city's Parks and Rec website to read the full report. So I'm going to do the following. I'm going to list these parks and talks about what the lead levels specifically were for these parks. The EPA's action level for playgrounds is 400 parts of lead per million. 400 parts per million. So starting with Walltown on Guess Road, they took 102 samples, and the lead levels ranged from 458 to 3,480 ppm. The highest concentration was found 1 foot below ground. Shallow sampling showed levels of 1,300 ppm, which is over three times the action level for playgrounds. Most of the hot spots were within 50 feet of a tributary to Ellerby Creek, another next to a basketball court, and an old incinerator is the likely source. East Durham Park on East Main Street took 66 samples, and the lead levels ranged from 723 ppm to 3180. Like Walltown's, the highest concentrations were found at greater soil depths. The spot with 3180 was a foot deep. The shallow sampling at the same location was 860 parts per million. Again, reminded that the action level is 400, so this is double that. All but one were in a grassy area along Main Street. No playground equipment on this tract, but it's adjacent to an apartment complex and functions as those residents' front yard. Northgate Park, Club Boulevard, lead level, they took 261 samples, and 34 of them contained lead, and that level 1,400 ppm. A single detection was an isolated incident, they say. And then the fourth, Lyon Park, L-Y-O-N, on West Lakewood Avenue, took 83 samples and found lead in 15. Lead level 553 p.m. Found in a wooded area on the far eastern side of the park, beyond the ball fields. And they determined a single detection was an isolated incident. No incinerator deposits were found. And finally, East End Park on North Alston Avenue. They found 23 samples that contained any level of lead, and those levels of those samples went from 435 and 995 p.m. at the old City Sign and Signal Shop, 770 p.m. near the former community center. They theorized the source at the community center is lead chips from paint used on the building's exterior in the 1960s. Two spots at the city's old Sign and Signal Shop, which is fenced off from the public, also had high levels of lead, presumably from paint used on site. And again, I have curtailed some of this, but you can find it at IndyWeek.com or NC Newsline. Those two journals published these stories about the contamination. Next, Jasmine Gallup wrote back in May 31st of this year, about a new book called The Black Reparations Project, edited by William Darity, Kirsten Mullen, and Lucas Hubbard, University of California Press. And Jasmine Gallup writes about this book. It's not an easy read, but definitely belongs on bedside tables. This collection of essays, edited by Chapel Hill writer A. Kirsten Mullen and Duke economists William Darity and Lucas Hubbard, with contributions by scholars on the subject, not only presents a persuasive argument for why Americans should make amends to the descendants of slaves, but also gives a detailed technical framework on how to do it. The book is subtitled A Handbook for Racial Justice, and it's a comprehensive follow-up to Mullen and Darity's award-winning work From Here to Equality, originally published in 2020. It is a must-read, writes the reviewer, Jasmine Gallup, for local, state, and federal politicians, college students studying social justice, and pretty much every American who has ever thought, reparations, that'll never happen. With the Black Reparations Project, Mullen, Darity, and Hubbard don't cater to people who already agree with them. Instead, they use the 200-some pages to outline concrete evidence of how the policies of the federal government have formalized discrimination, keeping Black Americans at the bottom of the economic ladder. The government is directly responsible for creating the Black-white wealth gap. They argue, therefore, it can and should be the institution to fix it. They write in the opening chapter, the federal government has sanctioned a past and present of American white supremacy. Therefore, the federal government bears the responsibility for the act of redress. The idea of reparations for slaves and descendants has been around since the Civil War. Various plans, starting with the famous 40 acres and a mule decree, have been launched and then abandoned. During the 2020 presidential election, the idea of making reparations was revived by various Democratic candidates, sparking new energy around the subject. Mullen, Darity, and Hubbard argue we must take advantage of that political energy to advance reparations before Black Americans are forced to endure yet another century of injustice. It starts by making the case for reparations. The editors recap a series of laws from 1861 to the present that have kept slaves and their descendants from upward economic mobility. Some of these laws might be familiar to readers: school segregation, the post-World War II GI Bill, and housing discrimination by the federal government, banks, and insurance companies. Other historical facts, however, may come as a surprise, like the fact that while former slaves were denied their 40 acres, millions of white Americans received 160 acres through the 1862 Homestead Act. Or the fact that white terrorists, starting after the Civil War, not only lynched and massacred Black Americans, but also seized their property and destroyed booming Black business districts. And how decades later, the construction of highways carved through vibrant Black neighborhoods, destroying Black prosperity and community stability, the editors write. Additional chapters on housing, education, and health care only strengthen the argument for reparations. Exploring details of American history many readers may be ignorant of. In one particularly compelling illustration, the book details how, in the early 1900s, 5 of 7 Black medical schools across the country were shut down, leaving the United States with a deficit of 30,000 Black physicians, according to a chapter written by Duke medical professor Keisha Bentley Edwards. One of the most interesting chapters, however, looks at how the amount of money due to the descendants of slaves should be calculated. In this chapter 6, authors examine the cost of discrimination across U.S. history and propose formulas that can be used to quantify that cost. And it's clear by the end that a $14.7 trillion payment, the amount the editors estimate it would take to close that gap, would be letting America off easy. Between the cost of slavery itself, including lost wages, compensation for pain and suffering, and the cost of discrimination, including lost economic opportunities and the reduced value of Black labor, reparationists can easily argue that African American community is due between $55 trillion and $24 quadrillion. We don't hear that number made often. A calculation made using conservative estimates and interest rates. By the end of the book, the conclusion is that a payment of nearly $15 trillion isn't literally the bare minimum for reparative justice. All right, we'll start the next portion, which is arts and culture-related articles. And the first one is by Byron Woods, and it's about the Arts Center in Carrboro. It's a $4 million, 17,000-square-foot home. Arts Center Executive Director Jenny Schultz-Thomas is ebullient as she ticks off a number of upgrades on a walkthrough through this new digs for the Arts Center, grand opening this weekend. That's one block off the intersection of Main and Weaver Streets in downtown Carrboro. They have accommodations for previously cramped ceramics classes in rooms whose floor-to-ceiling windows bring in the green of the neighboring forest space. Digital Lab and Maker Spaces are adjacent to a youth center, with arts instruction now for middle and high school students as well as the younger grades the Arts Center has traditionally served. A group of gallery spaces alongside a casual courtyard merch and coffee shop will let neighbors pop in for a drink and check out the wares of the artists working here. But one of the things Schultz Thomas is proudest of is the natural light that the city's painting and visual arts courses will have for the first time in decades. She says it's a gift to those artists who've been painting in the dark up until now. As she reflects on a dedicated room where teachers and students won't have to dismantle easels and workstations after each session, she says, I want to tell them you finally have the space that matches your abilities and your beauty. On August 26, Paper Hand Puppet Intervention led a celebratory noontime parade up the two blocks from its present quarters to a ribbon-cutting ceremony and an afternoon of music, exhibitions, and demonstrations at that new facility, 400 Robertson Street. But when Schultz Thomas turned in the keys to the old place, the organization left something important behind: a hand-me-down theater space. It's exactly what a neighboring theater company needs at this point in its growth. That's the Center Theater Company, an emerging and rapidly expanding children's theater company, and they've already outgrown a series of venues since its humble start as a neighborhood summer project back in 2020. With theaters shut down everywhere during the pandemic's early months, Jenny Latimer, a professional actor and director who graduated from UNC's Professional Actors Training Program in 2019, put together an outdoor production of A Midsummer Night's Dream for the kids in her pandemic pod. Soon their friends wanted in. She recalls, people just kept calling, asking, what's the next thing you're doing? Things got serious when 25 children showed up for the next outdoor production, Disney's Descendants. After that, Latimer and colleagues found themselves staging a series of spring, fall, and summer shows out of classes for children age 6 and up. When they outgrew a clubhouse at Southern Village, Latimer rented a storefront in an office complex on Garrett Road in Durham. In January, when she learned the Art Center's old space with a 300-seat Earl Wynn Theater would be opening up, she jumped at the chance to lease it. Latimer says, keeping that space alive is really important to me. Local concert and theater goers are familiar with the eccentricities of the Wynn space. Its two audience banks lie far left and right of center stage. In their midst is an open-air tech booth and a pit-like center section that college-based companies who produce there call the moat. I actually love it, says Latimer. It's so quirky. It always asks, hey, what are we going to do with this to make it work? Well, starting in September, Center Theater will begin holding classes and staging family-friendly productions in the space. They'll also continue hosting prominent itinerant regional companies. A full fall calendar includes Stone Soup's Cabaret and Pauper Player's Little Women in October, the North Carolina premiere in November of Alice by Heart by Company Carolina, and Center Theater's own December production of A Christmas Carol starring Derek Ivey. Meanwhile, after a period of introspection, the Arts Center will be busy refocusing, refining, and expanding its longtime core mission. Schultz Thomas says, we are community-based, focused mostly on education, and the numbers bear this out. With over 260 camps and classes for children and 294 adult-oriented arts courses, the Arts Center is the largest employer of teaching artists of any arts nonprofit in Orange County. Schultz Thomas says, we serve as an economic force for change and transformation, and our number one goal is that arts are accessible to everyone. To help achieve that, the organization is emphasizing openness and community engagement. the new space's opening exhibition by Dali Fellowship artists from the Diamante Arts and Cultural Center will foreground professional Latinx artists. Later on, the organization will co-host this year's West End Poetry Festival, sponsoring a children's poetry workshop with State Poet Laureate Jackie Shelton Green. Across its increasing public offerings, there is a clear impulse to define the Arts Center as an open space for approaching and accessing art forms, techniques, and technologies while reducing the social, educational, and economic impediments that often prevent that. Community Engagement Director Heather Tatreau says it's all about access. But to do this, the organization is shifting emphasis a bit away from the concerts and shows of the past. Schultz-Thomas says they'll still be a stalwart part of our identity, but it's not going to be the name of the game anymore. A flexible 150-seat theater suitable for intimate dance, music, and stage readings will serve, says Tatreau, as an incubator space for works in progress, from independent artists to creators associated with arts programs at UNC Chapel Hill and the American Dance Festival. Schultz-Thomas goes on, the diversity of our performances will diversify the performance base, what we're presenting and who can present. The sum of the current initiatives is really just going back to our roots, entrepreneurship on stage or in a lab. Arts Administrator Deborah Thomas notes that the Arts Center has always been a maker space of some kind, going back to its beginnings at Carr Mill Mall. That's always been its ethos the entire time. But how close they've been to that has varied over the years. The current center's change in focus feels like bringing that back to the forefront, engaging the broader community in a conversation about how we make it more do-it-yourself for everyone in the community. And now, before continuing to a next arts-related article, I will recall to you that the Hopscotch 2023 Festival is now underway in downtown Raleigh, all over downtown Raleigh, with outdoor stages, and then in the evening at various nightclubs and small club shows. I read several of those, I believe, last week's issue. And so if you need a guide, you can look for Hopscotch Club, and you'll find all the venues, and the indoor performances are paid, and you'll need to purchase tickets or tickets to multiple performances. And those last till after midnight in many, many cases. So small club shows is back, as well as the larger outdoor stages. Hopscotch 2023 runs today, Thursday, to Sunday. To Saturday. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of this week. So it's going on. And in the evenings, at least, it ought to be livable. You're going to be able to get in without shrinking five suit sizes from the heat. Hopscotch. Now, a fairly long list. Hopefully it's comprehensive. By Byron Woods about what Triangle Theater to experience this fall arts preview. And he writes, two of the highest profile itinerant independent theater companies in the region, Honest Pint and Sweet Tea Shakespeare, have something disheartening in common. You won't be experiencing them on regional stages this fall. Company representatives cited the lack of usable and affordable space. That's a decade-long problem in the Triangle, when they couldn't confirm scheduled productions before 2024. Only a last-minute breakthrough as Indy went to press kept a third, the Redbird Theater Company, off that list. They will produce Dominique Morisseau's Pipeline at Center Theater Company's Old Digs in Durham, November 30th through December 9th. Among the persevering independents, Bulldog Ensemble will take Samuel Hunter's A Case for the Existence of God to Durham's Mettlesome November 9 through 19th, before Pure Life Theater shows August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom at William Peace University, September 15 through 24. In October, Scrap Paper Shakespeare, whose two summer shows marked a quantum leap for that fledgling company, goes out for drinks with Prince Hal, an original adaptation of the Henriade, to be staged where the errant young prince spent most of his time in various bars. The independent pub crawl continues with other Only Windows, reprises, Barroom Beckett, an existential vaudeville of staged readings, songs, and the like, November 14th at the Tap Yard Tavern Room. Look for a screening of Obey the Beholder around Halloween from Egg Nymph Artist Collective, their second initiative after a triumphal inaugural production of Ann Baker's The Aliens in March. Is a short horror film that focuses on a boyfriend-girlfriend meet-the-family gathering that doesn't quite go as expected. Hold space also for the Blue Box Theater, December staging of Helen of... a new revisioning of one of the most reviled women in history, and brace for first sightings of the region's newest comedy group when Lucky Street Comedy hits Center Theater Company's new Carborough Digs on September 29th. Now, among housed regional companies, Burning Coal scores a casting coup with Susanna Skaggs from Netflix's Love and Gelato as the lead character based on mathematician Ada Lovelace in the City Company's season opener, Tom Stoppard's Arcadia, there in October 12th through 29th. And Playmakers Repertory, PRC, opens its season on September 6th with Clydes, Lynn Nottage's award-winning 2022 dramedy that has skyrocketed to become the most produced new play in the United States. Following that, renowned PRC stage designer McKay Coble spooks us one last time before retiring with Stephen King's Misery in a show whose October run overlaps with a parallel production at Raleigh Little Theater, October 20th through November 5th. Now, before I continue with this, I'm going to parenthesize. This is all theater, and of course there's a huge visual component. I know that some of these theaters that I've been naming, the larger ones at any rate, include described action often available to people with vision difficulty, who can sometimes receive a commentary about action that is occurring besides what you may hear of dialogue. And so you look for that in these larger theaters particularly, who have that capability of broadcasting, in effect, action commentary that does not get in the way too much of what you can hear. All right. Back then, where are we? Okay. Before its October production of 12 Angry Jurors, the Justice Theater Project presents a book-in-hand reading of Sholem Ash, the Dead Man, a remembrance of a Jewish community in Poland as it tries to move forward right after the First World War. September 7 and 10 at the Jewish Community Center of Greater Raleigh. And rounding out the residents, Theater Raleigh grills dysfunctional families and well-intentioned interventions alongside the hot dogs and burgers in Barbecue, before North Raleigh Arts and Creative Theater hits Halloween with the Rocky Horror Show. Look for high-level theatrical incubation this fall in multiple venues. 23 years after helping playwright Jose Rivera give birth to references to Salvador Dali, Make Me Hot, the Duke New Works Lab hosts a workshop of Rivera's new play, Lunar Rhapsody, on September 29th, following an earlier work that focused on UNC Black Trailblazers, the first black students who integrated that university in the 50s and 60s. Process series curator Joseph Meagle presents Performing Sankofa on November 30th and December 1. Before that, NC State University Theater presents the world premiere of What We Grew Up With. That drama centers on a family experiences immigrating to America just after 9/11. Was written by Kiran Soma, who won the university's Creative Artist Award in theater this year. And among the presenters, Duke Performances kicks off its rebranding as Duke Art Presents this week with audacious, mind-bending works. Outdoors, the fantastical Birdmen of the Netherlands Close Act Theater will take to the sky outside Duke Chapel in front of Baldwin Auditorium on September 7th or 9th. Indoors, viewers will don Oculus virtual reality headsets to interact with live performer on a stage in Sweden in Slumberland's Why Can't We Sleep? Leave it to a stranger to tell you your own story. In Chapel Hill, Germany's Rimini Protocol concludes its residency with Carolina Performing Arts with 100% The Triangle, an immersive work created with a group of 100 people who were chosen to carefully reflect our region's current demographics. And that will close that particular article. I have to move on. I only have 12 minutes left in this show. So let me see what else is in the folder. And let's take a look at jazz. Keisha Jennings has written an article that actually today was printed about Cicely Mitchell creating an ambitious downtown Durham social hub for jazz lovers. It's not every day that American Main Street gets a new jazz venue, read an announcement post earlier this summer. For Missy Lane's Assembly Room, the new venue is located at 310 Main Street. It's Cicely Mitchell's latest love letter to Durham and is slated to open late this fall. Over the past 11 years, Mitchell has embodied curatorial ambition with a diverse, engaging slate of projects across the Triangle. Her accomplishments range from founding the Art of Cool project in 2012 and organizing the Art of Cool Festival in 2014 to serve as BU CAF's booking director and curating that restaurant's innovative jazz programs. And in 2019, she took on the role of artistic director for the Summer Stage event series at Golden Belt. And for the past 3 years, her entertainment consulting company, Sawendaway Clap, has led the stage activations at Boxyard RTP. Collectively, these endeavors showcase Mitchell's distinct ability to curate dynamic artistic experiences that leave indelible marks on Durham's local music scene. Located downtown next to Weldon Mills Distillery, the 240-capacity venue will dramatically expand Durham's musical footprint. It also marks Mitchell's return as a presenter. Mitchell tells Indy, "It's always been a dream of mine to launch this space. It took me a long time to get back inspiration, to bring forth a concept. It's just very serendipitous on how it happened." Nish LeBlanc, CEO of Lennox & Gray Incorporated and a close friend of Mitchell's, is the building's owner. Her invitation to Mitchell to explore the unfinished space earlier this year has yielded remarkable results. Although she was a little hesitant at first, Mitchell says she was captivated by the space potential and the visionary essence of what a jazz venue in it could be. She says, "I thought to myself, I'm just going to dust off my old business plan and see where this takes me." The spark of recognition of the venue's possibility set the stage for a new creative collaboration between the pair. The venue's name is drawn from a nickname given by Mitchell's late grandfather. "My middle name is Elaine," Mitchell says, "but my people are from Greenwood, Mississippi. And so my grandfather said it so fast, together it sounds like Miss Elaine, Miss Elaine." Jazz venues have historically played an instrumental role in preserving cultural heritage of jazz music. They provide a platform for musicians to showcase their talent, connect with audiences, and contribute to a local arts scene. The Triangle is home to a vibrant and supportive environment for jazz education and appreciation. NC Central has a well-regarded jazz studies program, and while not exclusively a jazz school, Duke University offers jazz programs and has a strong presence in the area scene. For all its credentials, though, the Triangle is not home to many designated public spaces to experience jazz. In 2018, with a renewed focus on expansion, Durham's BU Cafe dropped its regular jazz-focused programming. And in 2022, after a decade-long run, Raleigh's premier jazz spot, C. Grace, closed its doors. There's Sharp 9 Gallery, a spot serious listeners can seek out, but it's not located downtown and operates more as a listening room. In June of 2022, jazz community lost Megan Stabile, a local promoter whose taste united jazz and hip-hop. Mitchell was inspired by Stabile, and the two had shared a close relationship that was solidified through their love for jazz. For Mitchell, the loss prompted questions about who will carry on the storytelling traditions of jazz and black music for the next generation, and Missy Lane's Assembly Room is one answer to that question. Over the past year, Mitchell has felt the pull to offer curated experiences once again. When it opens, she hopes the space will be more than just a music venue. She wants it to be a multifunctional social hub for jazz lovers to enjoy themselves and connect. In the mornings, there'll be a coffee bar and open meeting rooms in the front room. Beginning in the afternoon, a bar will serve cocktails. Mitchell also hopes the space will play host to soul yoga classes. In the background to all this, expect playlists made by Mitchell herself. She says, that's why it's called Missy Lane's Assembly Room. I envision it to be a space where Durham can commune together. She views this new venture as an evolution of cool. A distinct feature of the venue is its unique showroom layout, which features two different floor setups, one with cocktail tables and chairs for seated shows and the other adaptable for standing shows. Mitchell and her team are looking forward to experimenting with how the music is experienced with the flexible floor set. Durham is home to a lot of great music venues, but Missy Lane's feels an unmet need. Mitchell says, I think one thing that was missing up till now was a place that truly carries black American music and culture in an authentic way. The top venues in this area have been known to champion punk or indie rock. This is a space where jazz, funk, and R&B music is going to be booked regularly. Nevertheless, music enthusiasts from various genres will still have the opportunity to book space at the venue. Mitchell's sole requirement, which remains consistent with her core values she adopted from Art of Cool days, is that performances be live and not pre-recorded or tracked. When asked about a dream lineup for an opening show, Mitchell excitedly lists Ninth Wonder, Fonte, and Nina Freelon as her top picks. Backed by years of professional experience, Missy Lanes is giving Mitchell an opportunity to apply what she has learned. When asked about the key takeaways from Art of Cool's festival journey this far, her response encapsulates a journey of evolution, creativity, and unwavering dedication. She says, I want to revisit our earlier work from Art of Cool prior to launching the festival. This entails curating local performers and elevating them artistically. My vision is to revisit collaboration with local musicians to create more jam sessions, diverse dance nights like Latin dance, and open mic events. I also miss our custom performances like Carolina Soul, celebrating artists such as Nina Simone and John Coltrane. It's important to remember that Art of Cool project was started by Mitchell and Al Strong, a jazz musician who is also a product of NC Central's jazz program. Collectively, the pair's jazz roots run deep. On October the 7th, Missy Lanes will host Made in Durham, a Little Brother block party. Organized by Mitchell and her team, the event is set to celebrate 20 years of the hometown legend's debut project, The Listening. VIP ticket holders will have access to the inside of Missy Lanes, and the experience will also include drink tickets and small bites. She says, I'm excited about activating that block and that specific side of downtown because it's right outside the loop. People tend to forget about that area because it's mostly government buildings and churches. But then something needs to connect the center of downtown with that corridor out east, where Mezcalito, the Fruit, and Golden Belt are. And then further out, there's Rofiwa and Mike D's. Hopefully, Missy Lanes will be that connector. I may have a chance just to excerpt this last article by Sarah Edwards, Lena Geller, and Tazo Herzog. Fall Arts Preview, 10 Triangle Exhibitions to See. And I'll just list them as briefly as I can. First, through September 17th, at the Horace Williams House in Chapel Hill, King Nobuyoshi Godwin and Yuko Nogami Taylor. King and Yuko. It's a painting exhibition. Next, a Click Photography Festival, various venues across the Triangle, September 23rd through November 4th. Amy Herman, Until and Then Again, at the Peel Gallery in Carborough through October 1. And that's Slump Lump, Raleigh, through October 8th. Flump, clump, sag, dangle, droop. Those are the words that this is the latest group art show. Furniture, Crafting a North Carolina Legacy at the North Carolina Museum of History, September 16th through March 21st. Leading by Design, celebrating 75 years at the College of Design, is over in Raleigh at the Gregg Museum of Art, and that opens soon on September the 7th. Act as if you are a curator, an AI-generated exhibition at Nasher Museum in Durham, September 9th through January 14th. The Outwin American Portraiture Today is over in Chapel Hill at the Ackland Art Museum. That's November the 3rd through January the 21st, 2024. And finally, Blow Up at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design in Raleigh. Oh, not quite. It's been 100 years since Laura Wilder bopped up around a blown-up pig's bladder in an innovative moment from the children's book series. It's inflatable art. And then Louis Ray Velasco at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Raleigh, and that's now through January the 28th. Well, I brushed breathlessly through that, and there are several other articles I'm placing back in my folder. They're all culturally based, and I will save them for the next issue or issues of Indie Week. John Federson with you at the North Carolina Reading Service, which saves these broadcasts as podcasts, and you can find them at ncreadingservice.org, which has been your host for this show. And so John Federson says bye-bye.